Next up on This Week in Law, we're going to talk about when resistance to government requests is futile and when it might just be a business model. And why on earth are people still torrenting Breaking Bad when it's available legally and in a timely way? We'll look at that. We've got the CEO of Comply with us, Tom Chernak, and also Matt McDonald from Famigo. Evan Brown's here too. Lots more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 223, recorded August 16th, 2013. Comply or die. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code TWILL. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. We've got a wonderful show for you today. If you are concerned about staying on the straight and narrow as you use the internet, and if you're not staying on the straight and narrow, how you can best avoid the legal troubles you might get into. We've got some great folks joining us today. We have the CEO of Comply, Tom Chernak. Hello, Tom.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. It's wonderful to meet you. I've heard a lot about your company for a long time, and you guys are doing some very interesting stuff.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Also joining us, and Evan will be thrilled to hear it, VP of Operations and a former philosophy major over at Famigo, Matt McDonald. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Denise. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's not too often that we have someone who shared an undergraduate interest in philosophy as my co-host Evan Brown does.
Yeah, there aren't too many of us out there, and those who are in a library somewhere.
Yes, it's heartening to see someone, you know, gainfully employed and working right in a field that is not purely academic. So welcome. I'm also really interested in what you guys are doing at Famigo. The wonderful thing about having Tom and Matt together on the same show is they are both experts one way or another in legal compliance with things like FTC requirements. So, you know, we've talked about a lot recently about the changes to COPPA, the changes in the FTC blogging guidelines. So we're definitely going to get into that stuff and some recent wrinkles in those areas. But before we do, I want to welcome back to the show my before-mentioned co-host, Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Yeah, I'm happy to get in talking about any of those things. But if we wanted to devolve or evolve into metaphysics or epistemology, that's fine with me, too. So it is great to see a gainfully employed philosophy major, because as I always said to people when I was in college, you know, when I get out of college, I won't have a job, but at least I'll understand why not. So always good to try to bring reality into things that you don't expect. So great to be here. Looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. I wish I had that kind of a justification for, you know, when things in my professional life are not going so well. But English can be a bit of an esoteric major too, and that's what I was. But let's start by looking at COPPA and some things related to kids in general. COPPA, of course, is the Child Online Privacy Protection Act. And as of July 1st, some new revisions to COPPA came into play. And so we're still sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop as companies begin to start to get their hands and heads around what these new requirements are. We talked about it when the new requirements came online on July 1st. And Matt, your piece for VentureBeat is one of the ones I think we featured on the show, 10 Rules Every Business Should Know About the New Guidelines. So now that we've had a little time with them, I think there are still big questions remaining. One of them we were talking about right before we started the show today, and maybe we should start there. COPPA in particular is directed two applications that are directed to kids. And I think that that's a really murky issue in today's day and age. It's sort of the Joe Camel problem. You know, you've got a product or a service, or in many cases now an app, that is maybe not developed with kids in mind at all, but may be appealing to and very popular to kids. And this is something that developers are going to need to be cognizant of and have a whole lot of hoops to jump through under the new COPPA rules. So why don't we start there, Matt, and tell me what you think directed to kids means these days.
You know, that is a good question. I think that there are a couple of issues with that part of the rule. One is that it's not, you're right to note that it's not at all clear what directed to kids means. For example, you know, the COPPA legislation draws this distinction at the age of 13. And I think that, you know, it's not like children develop in such a way that there's this cliff that they fall off at the age of 18 and they're no longer children. So I think that's one of the strange tensions in laws, that it doesn't really take, you know, if the intention is to protect children from transgressions and making mistakes because they don't know better with regards to their disclosure of information, it seems weird to draw such a bright line at the age of 13. And then I also think that one of the other things that's interesting that you see, we work a lot with app developers at Famigo. We distribute content through our application. And so we're concerned about our partners being COPPA compliant. And a lot of the people that we talk to have mentioned this phenomenon that occurs over and over again, which is it's safer to have a clearly child-directed product, or it's safer to have a clearly adult-directed product. And the result is that I think that there's relatively less content, at least over the short term, that's going to be available for tweens. And I think that that raises some interesting issues about access to information, as well as just, you know, these are the heaviest mobile users. And so if we don't have good and engaging content there for them, what are they going to get into as opposed to, you know, to stuff that is high value?
What concerns me is I don't think, and anybody chime in with their thoughts on this, but it doesn't seem to me that developers who are trying to come up with a great product that will have some kind of hook and draw people in are sitting there actively asking themselves the question, is this directed to adults or kids? And it seems to me that that's what COPPA wants and assumes will happen. But we were talking about Minecraft before the show. We all either have members of our family or know people who are big Minecraft players and who are under the age of 13. And again, you know, I don't know the whole history, the whole short history of Minecraft, but my impression is that it was developed by adults who like to play the game and navigate the world, and that the initial users were like-minded adults, and then it sort of navigated down to this is a great game for kids. So, I can think of dozens of other examples out there that are popular games, Dragonvale, Angry Birds, you know, I mean, these all have very strong cores of adult users and are very appealing to kids. So, you know, is there just a disconnect between what the FTC expects and how developers actually make products? What do you think, Matt?
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think you can think about maybe the better way to think about it is not just apps and games, but to think about it in the context of media more broadly. And so Think about some of the best movies of the past 10 or 20 years. Pixar has made a lot of them. And those are films that are enjoyed by children and adults. And so I think that, you know, one of the concerns here is, yeah, the developer's probably trying to produce a product, especially if you're targeting a family audience, you're probably trying to produce something that's going to have multi-generational appeal. And so I think it's the problem is a little bit deeper than just not asking yourself, is this child-directed or is it not? But that people aren't really trying to make products that are so narrowly defined. You know, if you want App Store success, you need to reach more than just children or just adults.
Right. So, Evan, this isn't something that people can afford to get wrong, is it? We saw a bad example of what happened with Path, where they had a bunch of minor users that they were collecting data from. They ultimately entered into a settlement with the FTC for $800,000, and a whole lot of other supervision and requirements, restrictions from ever violating COPPA again. And the thing is, they just skipped a step, didn't they? They had a bunch of users then. They didn't know that they were kids, although they were harvesting birthdays from them. That was a big problem for in the Path issue. So they were not making a product that was necessarily particularly attractive to kids, but they had kid users. And once they were there, boom, they were hooked, right?
Right. And this touches on one of the essential problems of COPPA, that's really kind of twofold, I think. One, it's expensive to comply with, and it's very labor intensive as well, and often ineffective. You know, one of the things that you have to do is get verifiable parental consent, and that's problematic because parents either are not busy or don't have the time, they're too busy to actually do this, or they don't care. And so that puts the provider and the kid sort of left out in the cold, being able to participate in this anticipated transaction here. The other problem of it as well is, and this is what you're alluding to with the Path problem, and plenty of other companies have fallen to this as well, is that when the FTC comes after you, if it indeed does fine the entity for doing this, that's terrible. Not only the fact that it's $800,000 or, you know, lots and lots of money, but there's a real stigma to that. And bloggers and the media love, it's great headline material saying such and such was slammed by the FTC for not caring enough about children. You know, how polarizing that mm-hmm. is. So, you know, that with this problem here, that is what makes it really scary stuff, that the two aspects of that problem. The reality of it is the federal government only has limited resources, and every violator of COPPA shouldn't expect to get caught. FTC usually goes after the big fish in the pond here, but at the same time, nobody is completely without risk, even if the chances of the FTC knocking on your door are not all that great. So it's a difficult system to live in.
Yeah, this was early on in the history of Path. I wouldn't have called them a big fish at all when they got hit. So, Tom, your company is all about compliance, but have you folded COPPA into your services yet, or no?
We have not focused on COPPA. It's something that's obviously important to the space. But we really focus on disclosures, disclaimers, and other information that get attached to messages that are being sent out.
Right. Okay, Matt, one more question for you before we get to some more recent developments concerning COPPA. And that is, I'm wondering, Evan touched on it. I know your company touts itself as having always been compliant with COPPA and always will. How do you recommend that people manage the parental notification and verification of consent? Because that seems to be a real difficult task.
Yeah, so, and I think that's a really important question. When you read the statute and you look at the requirements for verifiable consent, one of the things that the rule does is it provides you a couple of pre-approved options, but then it also includes language, and it says that any other means that is reasonably certain, given the available technology to accomplish the goal of that part of the rule, is acceptable. And so you get this wonderfully vague charge to go and figure out how to do verifiable parental consent in a way that makes sense. And so I think one of the things that we need to do as in the developer community is figure out other methods of verifiable consent. The methods that are there now that are pre-approved are things like email plus. So the idea there is you're sending an email to the parent, and this gets into some of the issues that Evan just cited about the cost of compliance. So, you know, we use the email plus method, and that required, additional servers and things like that. So I think that And then also you run into the problem of parents don't read these things. You've got an inbox stuffed full of privacy policies from all of the apps that your kids are using. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a parent that's going to read a 9-page document for the dozens of apps that kids are playing. So I think that the developer community really does need to kind of stand up for itself and to look at some additional methods of getting verified consent. There are some promising methods. One of them is the ability to use a paid transaction that provides the parent with an itemized bill. And so I think that folks that have subscription services, they might be able to make that argument. But I think that the real issue is that people are afraid to try anything that's not specifically authorized by the law. And I don't think that that's just developers. I think that that's the attorneys for these developers as well. And so I think that you know, what we really need to do is focus on the end goal here, which is not legal compliance. It's protecting children's privacy. And I think that there are ways that we can do that that have lower compliance costs and make more sense for developers and for consumers. You know, you want to tell parents what information you're collecting from their children, but requiring you to do so in an email notification in a giant privacy policy is probably not the best way to accomplish that goal.
What do you think about text messaging as a way of accomplishing this?
Well, you know, the pushback is always, how do you know that it's the parent that's receiving it? And that's kind of the pervasive fear behind verifiable consent. So, for example, mm-hmm. in the Email Plus example, you have to send two emails. One, the first one, there's a concern that maybe the kid has hacked into their parent's email account or used their password. And so you send another one a reasonable amount of time later, and hopefully that reaches the parent. And so I think that the response by the FTC and by the legal community is going to be, well, the text message is just going to go to the kid, and they're going to be able to click accept. And that seems, you know, there's a point at which an application developer cannot serve the function of the parent any longer.
Yeah, very true. All right, so Apple seems to be finally responding to the changes in the guidelines, which, you know, if the app developers themselves weren't going to individually respond, if they hope to sell in the iOS App Store, they're going to have to now because Apple has updated its developer guidelines for approval of apps in the App Store. They now need all apps for kids. And then again, we run into this, okay, well, what's an app for kids? But they, if you can identify it as an app for kids, it needs a privacy policy. It needs behavioral advertising restrictions and a prompt for parental consent for in-app purchases. So that's one response that we're seeing. I think it indicates that, well, it probably indicates a couple of things. Apple has always been sort of proactive or very proactive in creating the environment that is the iOS App Store. So I think they've, you know, some of this decision must be motivated by, you know, this is the kind of app that we want to see for kids in the store. Some of it must be liability motivated, don't you think, Matt?
Yeah, I do. I think that there are probably two primary sources of motivation, or maybe three. I think two of them are business related. So Apple has a big portion of its business revolves around selling these products into schools. And so one of the things that's interesting about COPPA compliance in the educational industry is that schools have the ability to provide consent in sort of a wholesale fashion for all of the students that they are delivering these products to. So I think that I think that this is partially motivated by that. I also suspect there's a what's called the platform exemption, which is not specifically part of the COPPA rule. It's, you know, there's no language that says, hey, Apple and Google are exempt. But when you read the rule, it's pretty clear that that a lot of the issues or a lot of the compliance hurdles that apply to developers don't apply to Apple. And so I think that it probably wasn't going to take the FTC too long to say, you know, if we change the behavior of these two entities, we get a lot further along the privacy, through the privacy landscape and towards more transparent data use and collection practices than if we try and enforce it against hundreds of thousands of developers. So I think that, you know, you'll probably see that change. But the other thing is that because of the behavioral advertising restrictions, you'll notice that Google Play does not have a kids section of their store like Apple does. And I think that if you look at the proportion of these two organizations' revenue that come from advertising, that goes a long way to explain why you've seen Apple make this move first.
Yeah, very interesting observation there. Evan, what do you think about the fact that now if you're under 13, you can have an iTunes account?
Well, that's, you know, that's intriguing. And I mean, clearly the 13 cutoff is because of COPPA. I think there wasn't that something to do with being affiliated with a school, though? Is that right?
Yes.
I mean, I'm just kind of turning the question back. I mean, that goes to the point Matt was making about the school being able to provide consent. So it's not like kids everywhere are home free to get their own iTunes accounts. But, there's something to say about expanding that market. Apple certainly has an interest in doing that. And there's been talk about other platforms opening up their user base to kids under 13 as well. That's made news in the past few years. So it just seems like a natural extension of things, so long as the right things are being done under the law here. So yeah, no doubt it's intriguing.
Yeah, how they're doing it is only approved educational institutions are going to be able to request iTunes accounts for their students, and then they have to facilitate Apple obtaining verifiable parental consent for personal Apple IDs for students under the age of 13. So they're really putting the onus on the school to do the verifiable consent hard lifting, which kind of ignores the fact that, you know, I mean, we're all here. I think all of us, we didn't have Tom on the phone when we were chatting before this show about all having kids using these products. So I don't know if you're in the same boat, Tom, but, you know, we all have kids that use apps, and of course they're all using them on, that means, our own accounts. So it's just kind of a, you know, it's not a lie or a hack. It's just, as a practical matter, that is what's happening. You know, kids aren't allowed to have iTunes accounts, haven't been allowed to have them until very recently. Now they're allowed to have them through the schools, but it's not keeping them off any of these applications. How does Famigo handle that, Matt?
Well, you know, we're kind of right in the middle of it. So we have a product that is designed to go on to shared devices. So if a parent has a device that they want to share with their kids, it gives them a way to it provides a sandbox environment, and then the parent can hand the device to the child, and the kid won't be able to, you know, view those behavioral advertisements, make in-app purchases, and things like that. So that has been our you know, we think of that as the necessary conditions for a good product. So we're putting the parents in control. But I think that that's one of the things that that keeps getting left out of these COPPA discussions, is this isn't just about safety and security. It's also these devices are the way that we get information now, and they're the primary way that children get information. And so I think that our other sort of prong to this approach is to provide really good content that children want to engage with, so that they're less inclined to go seek out stuff that we might have misgivings about children accessing, or, you know, they might be less inclined to go make in-app purchases if you provide them with products that that already keep them entertained without those features.
Yeah, I mean, the whole in-app purchase ploy is a money-making one. So if you can figure out another way to provide the developer with what they need, without having to constantly get another hit to the credit card, that's probably a better model for games for kids. Do you guys try and skew toward that?
Well, you know, that's a good question too, because as developers ourselves at Famigo, we understand, I think, quite acutely how challenging it is to make a viable business by selling applications. You know, it used to be that people would only download free apps, and we're just starting to see folks being willing to pay for mobile content on a regular basis. And so I think that for a long time, in-app purchase has been a four-letter word. But there are times that it makes sense. And I think the issue, though, is that the onus is on the developer to do it in a transparent way and in a way that's not misleading. There are some developers that do a really good job of using in-app purchases. And so I think we should start to look to those folks to see how you can both you can protect the parents' credit card by making those purchases harder for the kids to find, or you can include security features, which is one of the things that Famigo does, to ask the parent if they would authorize that transaction, as opposed to, you know, what Apple does with the 15-minute window, where you can make any kind of purchase once the password has been entered for 15 minutes.
Right. And of course, you know, they now require the kid-focused apps to have parental consent for in-app purchases. Of course, if you are in the position of having the child using your own account, you just don't have to tell them your password. And then they have to come to you and say, hey, mom, can I buy this? And if so, please put in the password. That seems right to work pretty well, too. So, Matt, I'm curious. I know that you guys, to the extent that you're directly collecting information, that you're paying attention to COPPA, but as someone who is aggregating and pointing people toward a host of apps that you guys have vetted and reviewed and approved, what is your concern about sort of intermediary liability?
Yeah, so there was an FAQ, and this is one of the things that's been so challenging about the COPPA legislation. You had talked a little bit about the short history. So the rule was approved in December of 2012, and then the rule, we were supposed to get a period of time where you could ask questions and then get clarification. And so that rule and the FAQs weren't released until May. The first round of FAQs, and now they've continued to be released. And so every once in a while, you'll get something that will really kind of change your approach. And so one of them was an FAQ that did address this intermediate responsibility, which was just released at the end of July on the 25th. And the idea was that if an individual, the question was about whether an app with the ability to draw pictures that had a feature that allowed you to share to either a social media network or email, if you were responsible as the app developer for that feature. So really the question was, if you include a Facebook widget, are you responsible for ensuring that Facebook is COPPA compliant? Right. And the answer came back yes. And so that that decision and that response to that FAQ, I think, has changed our approach, not dramatically, but I think that we have, you know, we're a little bit more careful, and the way to address it, I think, is on the operational side. So how do we review these apps, and how do we vet them, and how do we make sure that, you know, that we're doing what we need to do? And I think that that's really the big point for us, is that COPPA is about process and being committed to, you know, an iterative approach to dealing with these issues as certain questions get clarified.
All right. Well, let us move on to another kid and also non-kid related issue, and that is web filtering. As we know, the United Kingdom is going to implement or is implementing ISP-based filtering for pornography and other things, it turns out, that will be on by default. Of course, filtering happens too when something like a P2P or torrent site is subject to a court order, and the court then orders that access to those sites be filtered. And it turns out that something like that happened recently to a torrent site in the UK. That torrent site was called easytv.it. It was blocked by court order. So the Sky ISP proceeded to block it, have filtering software that you know, they were one of the addresses that was filtered. And what turned out was that anything that EasyTV pointed to, for example, the Torrent Freak news-oriented website, was also blocked. So Torrent Freak found itself on the wrong end of some blocking when it, you know, certainly was not subject to any kind of court order. And it starts to show up the fact that these filters can be imperfect, as, you know, has always been the complaint. Also, Torrent Freak itself is reporting that the default on filtering, the types of sites filtered at least one of the ISPs includes a lot more than pornography. Default on filters for dating, drugs and alcohol and tobacco related content, gambling, games, social networking, suicide and self-harm, and weapons and violence.
Well, until you got to the last two, or maybe the second to the last one, I was thinking, well, just anything that's fun on the internet, you can't see anymore, right?
That's right.
It's like a switch. No fun or fun.
Yeah.
Well,
so this is
an interesting thing to point out as well. An interesting thing to point out as well is that the gambling laws in the UK are actually very different, and there are lots of forms of gambling that are legal.
So, yeah. At least in the TalkTalk ISP system, HomeSafe, that they use, those will be on by default unless someone goes in and unticks them. So let's talk about filtering for a moment. Anybody think this is a problem? What do you think, Tom?
I mean, I think that it's a difficult thing to make a call on what people can and can't access. And it's certainly an embarrassing call to have to make, to call in and ask for certain filters to be removed from your account. But, you know, it's not something that I necessarily see happening here in the U.S., hopefully not anytime soon. But it's concerning as to what people can at an ISP level grant access to or block. And even just making people request it has some privacy issues around it as well.
Yes. And the whole notion that you could target sites, you know, if you're subject to a court order, if you're, you know, going to take down a whole bunch of other sites, whether it's your competition or what have you, just by pointing to them, it seems that at least under the Sky ISP, that might be possible. Matt, what do you think?
I think that it's troubling, right? I mean, there's the persistent question of why, you know, who is getting to make these decisions. But I also think that maybe the other way to think about it is that there's a market for privacy developing. You know, as more commerce takes place online and on the internet, people are going to start voting with their dollars. And so I think that it makes sense to, you know, you're starting to see companies emerge, and we'll probably get to this later in the conversation, but you're seeing folks build products that have privacy in mind. And if consumers want those products and they want those privacy features, they're probably going to start voting with their dollars. And so I have a concern that just about the level of intrusion that these filters cause, and that maybe it's not the most efficient way to deliver the results that people actually want.
Evan, do you think that these examples of the filters being overbroad or perhaps put to purposes that are not intended by the UK government, do you think that that will result in any change, or are they just going to muddle through?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because that's precisely the issue that comes to mind for me on this. I think it's very different because it's happening in the UK versus how it would be if it were here. I think there's something to be said about what Matt was just saying about the marketplace, and that could go either way. There could be a market for services that have this filtering capability turned on by default. It doesn't take us a big leap of imagination just to let the issues from our previous topic of conversation cascade over into this one about protecting kids, you know, parents wanting to protect their kids for that. But then there are all kinds of nuances to that. Does it actually make parents more lax and therefore the kids more likely to actually access bad content? So you can see it's not difficult to get into the weeds talking about this issue. So the thing that's most interesting to me is how this concept of collateral damage plays into this in terms of a restriction being too broad to match the problem that's there. And it's so fascinating to see how this concept of avoiding collateral damage has been in First Amendment jurisprudence long before situations occasioned by high technology caused us to think about these things. As we learn in law school, and if you read any federal case that's applying the First Amendment, any restriction on speech, you know, setting aside commercial speech and stuff like that, but generally a government restriction on speech has to be narrowly tailored to match the compelling government interest. And so the focus for inquiry here is that on it being narrowly tailored. It can't restrict more speech than what is necessary to meet that compelling government interest. So what we have in these situations here is situations where these restrictions are prohibiting access to content that's perfectly lawful. There's no compelling societal interest in banning that content for everyone. This is legal content for adults. And we see that in the example of the default settings for the internet service provider in the UK that's allowing restrictions, you know, like we were saying earlier, turned off just everything fun on the internet. You can't access that. And you also see it in the possibility of unintended consequences for what happened to TorrentFreak with with the actual torrent site redirecting the DNS in such a way that TorrentFreak was taken offline. So that's kind of a different flavor of it, but that's the result of the overbreadth of a content-based restriction like that. So for me, the most interesting thing is seeing this concern about restrictions being narrowly tailored playing out in a very modern context like this.
You know, one of the I just wanted to jump in because one of the things that we've seen, so this conversation about defaults is very interesting. So for a long time, we had inside of our product, we had an unlock button that the child could see. And what we noticed was that the kids started to think that it was a game. So they saw this unlock button, and then you had to enter a passcode to get out of the sandbox environment. And so they started to try and get out, and they started to try like crazy. And we kind of banged our heads against the wall for a long time, and we said, well, why don't we just move it one level lower? And when we did that, it stopped being a game. And so I think that we need to think pretty carefully about the default. So are we... You know, do these filters just challenge people to get around them? And so they kind of raise all these legal First Amendment privacy issues, but then they're not really even doing their job in the first place. And maybe a more sensible solution is to let the consumer decide what the defaults are. And I think that, you know, that's something that, you know, we've seen in studies over and over again, that the defaults really do impact behavior and people go along with the default settings the vast majority of the time. So setting it to the most restrictive as opposed to, you know, having a setup process where the consumer can choose, I think is also pretty troubling.
Just to play the devil's advocate, I'm not necessarily trying to undermine what you're saying because I think it's valid and I think it's good and sound and all that. But if you let the consumer set the defaults, wouldn't that just be what the status quo is now? I mean, we have the ability to go in. I mean, you've got to be a relatively sophisticated user to go in and mess with OpenDNS and block certain IP addresses from being seen. But wouldn't that sort of eviscerate the whole intention behind all of this, which, you know, in the end may be a good thing if you let the consumer decide what the defaults are?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And you've got to do it in a way that doesn't require that level of sophistication. I think that that's a more troubling trend that we see with privacy and technology is that there's a barrier to entry to having some level of control over your privacy. And that's a certain level of technical sophistication. And that doesn't need to be the case. So I don't see why an internet service provider couldn't provide a relatively, you know, the companies that are making billions and billions of dollars of revenue a year, why they couldn't provide a relatively easy configuration so that on the setup of your ISP, you can tailor the settings to what you want.
Well, I think the lesson your company learned, Matt, is that maybe we have to put those default boxes in front of the kids and then let them decide, you know, oh, what? I can't watch porn. How am I going to undo that? Then they'd see that, you know, then the game would begin, as it were. Let's make a collateral damage our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you are a lawyer, you might consider submitting. If you're a viewer or listener to the show, you might consider submitting to your local bar to get some continuing legal education credit. If you're interested in doing that, we've got a page on our wiki at wiki.twit.tv that'll give you some help and guidance there. Also, we understand people in other professions sometimes get get credit for the show. So we go ahead and drop these phrases in so that some jurisdictions require you in a compliance-oriented way to demonstrate that you listen to the show. This is one way we can let them know that you did. So good luck with getting credit for the show. We love hearing from you if you're doing that. Let us know how we're all doing on that front. Now would be a good time to take a quick break. We're here today with Tom Chernak, the CEO of Comply, and Matt McDonald from Famigo, Evan Brown, and me. And we wouldn't be, except that we have a great sponsor for the show, which is ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet in an unfiltered way, if that's what you'd like to do. It works with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure encrypted tunnel through which all your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your browser, your email, your file sharing, any instant messaging programs. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location and giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. Well, ProXPN is such a great sponsor for this show, particularly at this time, because we are right in the middle of some really difficult questions concerning things like the filtering in the UK, concerning things like surveillance in the United States. People are definitely concerned about keeping their web activities secure and as unencumbered as possible with the Six Strikes program here in the United States in play. Even if you're engaged in perfectly legal online activity, if you simply think that you might trigger a red light at your ISP because of the volume of traffic or the type of activity there that you're perfectly legally engaged in, a VPN is a great way to go, and ProXPN is one of the best. It has complete online privacy with a 512-bit encryption tunnel. It works via OpenVPN or PPTP, you choose. You protect yourself against your ISP's six-strike rule, keep your personal internet usage private at work, bypass internet filtering and blocked sites. You can bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the United States, UK, Asia, and more. ProXPN makes your internet connection region-free, and its software for Windows and Mac offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN's servers. ProXPN also works with your iOS or Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public or corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. There's a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN. There's world-class customer support, and Steve Gibson has thoroughly kicked the tires on this product and given it a great review over on Security Now, so you know it's the stuff. Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for the entire year, but don't pay that. We've got a better offer for you. Use the code TWIL, T-W-I-L, and you'll receive 20% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code TWIL. Thank you so much, proxpn.com, for your support of This Week in Law. So here's my ProXPN-related question or VPN-related question of the week for the chat room. As long as we're on the subject of online filtering, we do use OpenDNS here at the house, but I would be very interested in using a VPN as well. And I'm wondering if those two things can coexist. As soon as I implement the VPN, does that mean the OpenDNS filtering goes away, or can you fine-tune that? I'd be interested to know the answer to that question, if anyone knows it. Okay, so in response to the filtering both of blocked sites by court order and the more nanny-oriented filtering in the UK, we have the Pirate Bay riding to the rescue on its 10th anniversary. The Pirate Bay has now unleashed the Pirate Browser with massive downloads and sounds like mixed reception over at InfoWorld. One of their writers in Thailand was testing it there against, his name's Woody Leonhard, was testing it there against the Thai filters, Thai government filters that are in place. And he had sort of spotty results. At first, it didn't seem to get around the filters at all. But then 15 minutes later, it did. So the Pirate Bay, of all people, is riding to the rescue to ensure, you know, certainly they have a self-interest here. With their site being blocked, they want people to be able to access their site. They are very careful to tell people downloading the Pirate Browser that it's not going to provide you any privacy. It's not providing anonymity. It's not secure to hide your identity. It's only supposed to circumvent censoring and website blocking. So they can't really make it fully anonymous. They say it would only slow down browsing. So, Evan, what do you think about all this?
Well, who else but the Pirate Bay is in a better position to do something like this? You know, what more need to be said than that? I mean, that last point you were making in that it doesn't help with anonymity in any way seems to be significant to the people in countries that you know could really get in trouble for trying to get around their countries, their government's restrictions on this kind of content. So, If you're into this kind of avoiding what your government requires or prohibits you to do, then it seems like a good tool. And, you know, yay for Pirate Bay.
Yep, exactly. Tom, any thoughts?
No, not specific to this. I mean, it's, again, I think that, you know, the filtering concept is one that that we're all, wary of. And obviously, I mean, I think that, you know, this is sort of the reverse of your sponsor is sort of, you're really just providing you access, where the, your sponsor is really providing, you know, sort of, more of a tunnel into content that would get blocked.
Exactly. At Famigo, Matt, I'm wondering if you guys ever flirted with creating a browser that would be a safe browser. We are dealing with a browser that would be, you know, an unblocked browser. But I'm wondering if you guys ever considered something like that.
Yeah, so we have, and it's actually in development. And mm-hmm. So I think that we've got a little bit of a different approach there, though. It's not... Mm-hmm. It, as opposed to just, sort of providing open access, what we would probably, or what we are doing, is whitelisting a list mm-hmm. of URLs. And then we use machine learning to understand what our users are approving as well. And so that gives us a bit of insight into, you know, to what our customers are actually desiring, so that it avoids that situation where we're making the decisions about what's acceptable. And it puts, sort of our community of users in the driver's seat. So we see a lot of value in it. And I think the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of these privacy discussions center around apps now, and the web is certainly not dead. And I think that, a lot of these discussions leave out sort of, you know, this web browsing filtering issue. And I think that, we're looking at that as more of a long-term game and something that it's more important to get it right than to do it first. And I think that that's something that even when you look at the history of Google, you know, they weren't the first search engine, but they did it well. And I think that that's going to be important here as well.
All right. Well, since we're talking about the Pirate Bay, let's look at some other issues related to Hollywood. So Breaking Bad, the last part of the final season, premiered and is on track to perhaps lap Game of Thrones as the most downloaded show via BitTorrent. It certainly has been downloaded like crazy. Let's see. Just a few hours after the first unauthorized copy of Breaking Bad appeared online, says Torrent Freak, 80,000 people were sharing the episode simultaneously through the most popular torrent file. After 12 hours, 500,000 people had already grabbed a copy via BitTorrent, and the number was increasing rapidly. But there's a really interesting piece by Ernesto over at Torrent Freak pointing out that this is all happening despite the fact that the folks in charge of Breaking Bad seem to be doing everything that people have been telling them to do to avoid privacy. Make it available legally, easily. Make it available as much as you can simultaneously so that there's not windowing where people are feeling left out while others around the globe are enjoying the show. And it's still, even though they've done a good job of that, people in the UK, I think, yes, Netflix subscribers could stream the latest episode a few hours after the US premiere, but tens of thousands downloaded it via BitTorrent anyway, a good 8.5% of all the downloads. So what's going on here, Evan? Why all the downloads still, despite the fact that things are more easily and legally available?
I've got an idea. Maybe it's that people like free stuff. You know, that could be it. And I don't know what. Yeah, I mean, sure. There's, there's plenty of people who say make the content available legally in an affordable way and in a way that's easy to purchase. And sure, that happens. And there you see the success of iTunes, for example, and any other example. You could look it into streaming media as well, where content is made available for free. But if the barrier to getting it is extremely low, like what it is with trading it by BitTorrent or whatever, I don't see how, in a economy that is populated by purportedly rational economic actors, I don't see why those who have the technical acumen and the capabilities and the knowledge and the experience of getting free content would stop doing that anytime soon. So there's really nothing anomalous that I'm seeing in this. People just want to get it if they can.
Well, I think that there's another consideration here as well, which is that people like to have their content in the way they want their content. And I came out of the music business. I watched this happen around MP3, where people consistently said, we want it in MP3. And the business kept saying, well, we want it in DRM. And it just ended up at a breaking point where people were just going out and getting it the way that they wanted to. And here you see, people are clearly downloading it. Maybe they want to take it on a device the way they want it. Maybe they don't want to just stream it. And I'm in a position here in New York where, there's a battle going on between Time Warner and Showtime. I happen to be a big fan of Dexter. And we've been blocked access because of a battle between the two companies for the last couple of weeks. And it's been really interesting because we don't have the ability through the normal channels to stream it. And it leaves us at a point where either we go on to a BitTorrent site and download it, or we have to wait until the companies resolve it so that we can actually get it the way that they intended us to.
Right, or you have another option, and that's Aereo. You're in New York, right?
Well, we have Aereo for CBS programming, and they've mm-hmm. actually offered that up from Time Warner, but mm-hmm. I don't believe that you can get Showtime through that.
Ah, that's right. Yep, just the network broadcasts, unfortunately. But it's interesting how this whole CBS-Time Warner dispute is giving Aereo a leg up. It doesn't do us any good here on the West Coast in light of a district court decision that the Ninth Circuit is reviewing that enjoined an Aereo competitor using basically the same approach. So we're still locked out of our CBS content unless we can figure out ways to not, I'm on a Time Warner ISP here, and my husband was wild to watch the PGA Championship last week, and he, we had to basically watch it on 3G or 4G or LTE versus via AT&T to be able to do that. And he had to watch on his iPad as opposed to the TV. So, first world problems to be sure. But the interesting bit is how Aereo seems to be getting a boost. And as you said, Tom, Time Warner is actually promoting them. That must gall CBS.
I was amazed. You know, I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. Time Warner has had a very different stance on the whole concept. But I was really amazed to see them actively promoting it as an alternative to get your CBS programming.
Yeah. Evan, any thoughts on this?
No. I lose track really quickly when, you know, these battles like with CBS and Time Warner, because, you know, they seem to always be going on in some iteration or the other. And, you know, so no, nothing to add here.
All right. One other thing on the piracy thought front I thought was interesting, and that is Comcast. And Jeff John Roberts wrote a great article over at GigaOM on this, pointing out all the various permutations. Comcast is going to try to deliver real-time ads to people to buy the show they're about to torrent. So it's going to require ISPs to create a real-time system that would display pop-up sales messages at just that instant, you know, when you're in the throes of infringement. What I thought was a real wrinkle in all of this that Jeff points out is, you know, once an ISP starts participating in the content they're delivering, as opposed to just being a pass-through, then they lose their Section 230 immunity, don't they, Evan?
Probably their Section 512 DMCA immunity. Yes and no. I mean, it's a complex question, because what we have with Section 512 immunity is the protections if certain hoops are jumped through and all that stuff. And one of the claims that one would have to make to successfully assert infringement against Comcast, either for direct liability or indirect liability, or sorry, secondary liability, I guess you could call it indirect liability, is that, among other things, they don't have benefit monetarily, don't have a pecuniary gain from the infringement. So it's on that point right there where serving up ads next to infringing content could be problematic in this analysis, the safe harbor analysis, and the analysis of the cause of action, the actual elements of the cause of action. So, you know, I remember thinking about an issue similar to this probably every bit of 6-7 years ago, when Rever came out. It was, you know, an early competitor of YouTube. I think it's been in the Deadpool for quite a while. But Rever was one of the first to append ads to videos that were being shown, you know, that users had uploaded. And so I remember one of the questions was, is this affecting the safe harbor protection because they are more clearly putting themselves in a position to benefit monetarily from the infringing content that's on there. So this, you know, that old issue kind of got tabled because now YouTube has licensing arrangements with a lot of the companies or with a lot of the content holders with which ads are placed. So I think that issue has lost its prominence. So it's interesting to see it resurrecting again. Especially from someone like Comcast, who is a media company, really has a clear incentive not only to benefit from those ads being served up from whomever would be placing the ad, but also to the extent that it would result in more sales of the actual content. But one thing this kind of bleeds into another issue here of this other element of secondary liability of having the right and the ability to control the infringing content. And I think it would go to that as well, because if Comcast knows enough to serve up an ad, well, then you would think that in the mind of Comcast, it knows that there's infringing content being transmitted there. You know, couldn't it stop it from happening in the first place? So I think that's certainly the most interesting point that comes out of this story. And John Jeff Roberts does a great job of teeing that up.
Yes.
Or Jeff John. Which is it? John Jeff or
it's Jeff
John? I get confused.
He's been on the show. He's Jeff.
I still can't remember, even though he's a friend of our show. I can't. we'll just call him JJ, right?
Yeah, there you go. I just think it's really funny to your point, Evan, that, you know, sometimes people just want free stuff and they're going to do it, you know, no matter what you throw at them in the way of warnings or liability, that Comcast could invest a whole lot into the system and throw up a whole bunch of ads that just get ignored and annoy. But who knows? They may have some effectiveness. And Sailor Lion is pointing out in IRC a good point on the CBS Time Warner dispute, that a VPN like ProXPN would keep CBS from knowing that you were on a Time Warner cable connection, and you might be able to get your shows that away. Have you thought about that, Tom?
Yeah, the challenge is that the login to get to Showtime is through your Time Warner account. So,
so
limiting.
Right. And I wonder, I know that, you know, certain outfits like HBO and Cinemax, does Showmax, Showtime have an online way that you can watch their shows, or are you kind of out in the cold there?
Yeah, I think it's the same system, and it's all based on your Time Warner credentials. So they want to make sure that you're already a subscriber. You can't just go in without having a cable account. So it really limits you, because they know by definition of who you identify as your subscriber, you know, as your subscriber account, they know that you're a Time Warner customer.
Right. All right, well, let's move from Hollywood to the social web. So the FTC is all over our show today. It's the entity responsible for enforcing COPPA, which we talked about quite a bit. It also is responsible for the disclosure guidelines that apply to bloggers and anyone else using social media. And that is what Tom's company, Comply, is all about. They have services that help you make sure that you are operating within those guidelines. So Tom is a real expert on all of this. And why don't you tell us what the state of things is right now? I know the most recent update was in March.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, it's important to remember that 4 years ago, and just to sort of bring it full circle, 4 years ago, the FTC in October of 2009 made a big update to what they call their testimonials and endorsements guidelines. That prompted me to start what is now Comply. And actually the first call that I made at the time was to Evan. So we've all come full circle here. Mm-hmm. But we called Evan and we said, you know, we know that this is a big problem. We know that somebody is going to need to address it. We have this idea. And the idea was, how do you make a disclosure, in particular in a tweet or a Facebook status update? And there were a lot of people who were very much up in arms as to how they would go about doing that. The testimonials and endorsements guidelines that were updated in 2009 talked specifically about the when you need to make a disclosure. And they were really an update to rules that had been, you know, put out back in 1980 and hadn't been updated in 30 years. The March update from this year is a pretty different concept, although they're very interrelated. The March update was called the .com disclosures, and that was an update to a document that was last updated in 2000, and that talks about the how to make disclosures and takes into account a lot of the things that we've been talking about today, the move into mobile and tablets, the fact that things are not just traditionally web-based, the ways that people are interacting in social are quite different from what traditionally people were doing, and certainly what people were doing back in 2000. So they've addressed a lot of those updates in the .com disclosures report.
So, Tom, how should companies, if you know, they've got various and sundry employees who are in an official capacity making online statements, and then everyone else has their personal accounts, how should they deal with all of this? And, you know, does everyone have to go through a whole series of training that has, you know, nothing to do with the actual content of their job, but how they're going to interact with the outside world?
Well, it breaks down into a few categories, and you bring up an important one, which is, you know, obviously employees talk a lot about the products that they work on, the companies that they work for, and there are some complex issues around that. But there is a need to make a disclosure if you have what's called a material connection to what you're talking about. So, for example, if I've been paid to write a review for something, I need to disclose that I've been paid to write that review. Obviously, if you're doing it because you work for the company, you are also being paid for what you do, and then there's a need to disclose that. The bigger need and what the FTC was initially addressing was outside influencers. So someone who has particular influence or is incentivized by a company, they're selected, they're brought in, they're given free product, or they're paid, or they're participating in some sort of an ongoing marketing initiative. And as a result of that, they're writing reviews, they're talking about the product, they're giving testimonials or endorsements about that product, and needing to include disclosures that make it clear to people that they're actually part of a marketing program and not just reviewing this of their own volition.
Right. So now that the March rules have been in place for a while, what are you seeing that works and what doesn't work so well?
They made a couple of really significant changes. Everybody, and there are lots of regulators who are looking very closely at social media. You know, in addition to the FTC update, there was an update from the SEC in response to Netflix and a report that they released saying that social media channels can be official channels. There's been a lot of movement for banks from a group called the FFIEC. And all of these regulators are looking at social media, understanding that these communications are very different, also understanding that companies and individual consumers are relying on these channels in very new ways. And they're all saying consistently, we are not changing our rules just because your platform is different. Just because your platform is limited to 140 characters doesn't mean that you don't need to include a disclosure or a disclaimer or something that you would be required to otherwise. So what the FTC did is they weighed in and they talked about the ways that people make disclosures. And one of the common methods was using hashtags, and people would add hashtag ad, hashtag spawn, things like that. And the FTC really is steering people away from that type of disclosure because they don't feel that it's clear enough, in particular if it's abbreviated, but they also don't feel that there's an understanding for consumers of what that actually means.
So you guys do URLs that actually convey some information in the URL. That's how you're helping folks get around this?
We do. So we base it on URLs for a few reasons. We believe that the disclosure has to be in the message itself. One of the issues that was raised in the .com disclosures is this concept of syndication. So if I post something on Twitter or Facebook, it's not necessarily only living there. It may go into other formats. It may go into other platforms. It may be seen with all of the information in an expanded view, or it may be seen in context of another platform or another device. It may just be limited to the text in the message itself. So we include it as a URL that's readable on its face. And one of the big updates that we've made recently and in response to the .com disclosures is we're using what we call our plain language URLs. So we actually own URLs that read as rules or terms or my disclosures that allow you to say directly in the message that there's a disclosure there, and then to make sure that that disclosure is, and in the words of the FTC, unavoidable when somebody actually clicks through to that link, that they're presented with that information in a meaningful way.
Yeah, that seems like a really good approach. And I'm glad you brought up Reed Hastings and his posting on Facebook and how that prompted the SEC to get all up in arms, because we've had a similar kind of thing happen this week with Carl Icahn, who decided to tell folks that they were holding large portions of Apple stock and that he was meeting with Tim Cook and things looked good at Apple. This was in the wake of the CBS News interview over the weekend, where the Oracle chairman was saying, we've seen Steve Jobs with Apple and we've seen Steve Jobs without Apple and they're not the same, or we've seen Apple without Steve Jobs and they're not the same company. So Carl Icahn managed to give the stock a bump despite all that happening and sent the stock soaring simply by, talking about the fact he was investing in Apple. How do you think that plays into SEC compliance, Tom?
Well, the SEC rules were originally promulgated back in the the 30s. And obviously we had a very different world back then. They've continued to interpret those rules in light of how changing technology, changing culture, you know, changing society adapts to these new tools and platforms. And again, they've looked at social media and they've said, we're not changing our rules just because your platforms are different, but you need to take these into consideration. And we will look at these channels as official channels. So long as you abide by certain criteria, you can use those channels. And that means that people need to promote it. And you've probably also seen that, you know, Carl Icahn is saying, you can follow my Twitter handle for more information. Things like that are things that companies are going to be required to do, because the challenge with Reed Hastings was that he was posting something in his Facebook page, and it was his personal Facebook page. A reasonable, you know, consumer or a reasonable investor wouldn't know to follow his private Facebook page for an update that's relevant to, you know, one of the metrics that the company is tracked by. However, the message that he posted in his private Facebook page was very relevant to a key metric that people were tracking for health of the company. So it's an evolving landscape. You know, I think a lot of people have paid attention to, and I forget what the exact value was that you know, Apple stock went up based on Carl Icahn's tweet. But these are real numbers, and these are real platforms, and people are really seeing not only the regulators, but people are really seeing, I mean, you know, what effect these messages can have. And you look at, you know, the AP hack a few months ago. You know, just saying, you know, by hacking the AP account and by posting, you know, that the White House had a few explosions, the stock market tumbled, and we're seeing real effects from these things. And the SEC wants to make sure that when these messages are sent, and certainly when they're sent legitimately, that people are presented with the right disclosure information, that people understand which channels to follow, and that, you know, that there's, you know, controls under the traditional regulations within these channels as well.
Just to fill in what you were wondering there, Tom, less than 2 hours after the tweet, Apple shares had closed up by nearly 5% at just under $490, still way off its 52-week peak of $705. But Evan, this is kind of a different wrinkle than the Reed Hastings issue, isn't it? Because here we're not having an Apple executive tweeting information about the company, but just an investor. But who knows, you know, what the backstory of that is. Does Icahn and Apple get together and decide, okay, we're going to talk up the stock? Or, you know, certainly the SEC's got to be concerned about this.
Yeah, and this might just be a one-off, because, I mean, it's Carl Icahn. You know, he owns stock valued at, have we already said this in some point in the conversation, $1.5 billion, but that's less than 1% of the value of the company. So it's not that he's this significant force other than, well, the fact that he owns $1.5 billion worth of stock. I guess I shouldn't be too diminutive of that. But, you know, it's just that the fact that he's Carl Icahn, which is what's making the story here. Yes, it's qualitatively different than Reed Hastings, because Reed Hastings is Reed Hastings in relation to the organization that he's in charge of. This is just an investor out here that carries some kind of name. So because of the fact that it is, you know, or at least I hope some people would agree with me in saying this is sort of a one-off, I hope that the SEC wouldn't do a whole lot of regulating or anything like this, because that would be, going back to this motif of being overly broad, it would be regulating a bunch of stuff that doesn't need to be regulated. And if we're going to start from the premise that those things that, you know, should be regulated are only those things that actually need it, then, you know, that would be a mistake to try to make new rules based on a situation like this. So I'm trying to see it as optimistically as possible and not go crazy and have and encourage anyone to have a big knee-jerk reaction over something like this.
Right. As CBS News wrote, that he only owns a quarter of a percentage point of Apple stock, but it's a loud quarter of a percentage point, given that he's Carl Icahn. So it's all a brave new world in, you know, what social media can do to the stock market and companies and individuals. Any final thoughts on the topic before we move off this, Tom?
Well, just again, that the rules don't change for social, and where you touched on employees before, where this becomes really challenging is you have employees or individual investors or advisors who are going onto social channels and either talking up or promoting or representing certain things. Becomes a real challenge in how you navigate that under the traditional regulatory structure. And how do you make sure that people aren't making claims outside of what you do? How do you make sure that it's clear to people that that these people either do represent, or more often it's even more important to say when they don't represent you in their own social channels?
Right. And if you go and check out our discussion points for this episode of This Week in Law, which you can find at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/223, there are some great resources that we haven't touched on here in the show. A lot of them over at the Comply site, a lot of them directly from the FTC. And I really liked something, it's called Do I Have to Disclose If? By Katie Widrick, who did her, she's not a lawyer, but she did her own job of going through all the resources and some specific case-by-case scenarios of whether you should disclose or not. So great resources there if you have questions along those lines. And since we have, before I go on to our tip and resource of the week, let's make Loud Investor our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law in honor of Carl Icahn. And as I was going to say, since we have two folks on the show who are very good at issues around COPPA and the FTC.com guidelines, and as I said at the top of the show, keeping you on the straight and narrow, I thought I would let Matt and Tom take over our tip of the week, and we'll make them tips of the week this week, one from each of them. So, Matt, what do you got for us?
Yeah, so I think the one tip that I would offer is a lot of the conversation today has been about some of the challenges that we face with legal compliance issues in the tech industry. And I think that I would encourage business owners and folks operating in this space to start to think very seriously about how your legal compliance can be a source of competitive advantage. I think Tom and Comply have done a really nice job of this. And I think that the tip is less practical and more change your mindset to thinking about these legal and compliance issues as a source of advantage, and maybe even as a source of value if you can figure out a way to do that as opposed to a cost on your business.
That's a good one.
I would agree completely. And, in fact, what we've found is, we started in legal compliance and a need to monitor for disclosures. But in the process, we built out a platform that actually measures all of the activities around social media in a completely new way and really looks at the value and the value of the engagement and where the engagement actually takes place, in a way that couldn't have happened without having a basis of legal compliance.
Right. So do you have a specific tip for us along those lines?
Yeah, I mean, I think that every company every individual who is blogging with these sort of material connections with participating in marketing initiatives needs to think through this. I'm also the co-chair of the WOMA Members Ethics Board. It's the word of mouth marketing association. We do have some updated guides that are coming out, but every company or every individual who has who works in this capacity needs to think about having social media policies, needs to think about the way that they engage in social and ensure that their various channels and approaches are in compliance.
Yeah, you guys both raised the issue that the hand-wringing and concern of the marketplace can lead to new and perhaps unexpected opportunities. One of the things we didn't get to discuss in detail today that was in the rundown, and of course people can read more about it, the discussion points that I mentioned, is that Mega is getting into the secure email business in response to things like LavaBit shutting down and overall concern about email privacy and being able to have not just a secure tunnel for your data to go through, but to know that if it's being held on somebody's server, that it's going to be secure there too. So here we have Kim.com now arising as the hero of email privacy if they go forward with this service in response to the market demand. It's a strange world out there. We do have a couple of resources of the week for you. One is Trolling Effects. You've heard of Chilling Effects. This is much along the same lines and involving some of the same players, the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at Berkeley, EFF, and Public Knowledge, the Consumer Electronics Association are all involved. And it is a great site for learning about patent trolls, submitting, as with the Chilling Effects site, submitting letters that you may have gotten, demand letters, et cetera, learning about patent reform and new developments on their blog over there. So do check out Trolling Effects. It also has a wonderfully cute little troll graphic that no one should miss. There he is. Also, a movie that fans of this show will no doubt want to check out. It's called Terms and Conditions May Apply. And before you can even see the trailer to the movie, you have to check a box that says, I agree to the terms and conditions, and click I agree, and that'll take you to the trailer and where the movie's being screened, etc. It is obviously a documentary about the issue of terms of service and what you are agreeing to by clicking through such things. And the terms under the trailer are quite entertaining. Down at the bottom, you can say, let's see, I'll read you some of them. In exchange for visiting this website, you have agreed to publish a post stating that you have visited this website on Facebook. Failure to do so may result in legal action. Further, and with the same applicable penalties, you have also agreed to watch the film Terms and Conditions May Apply in any or the following media: theatrical, video on demand, DVD, airplane, cruise ship, hotel, or building wall. So this looks like it's going to be a great one, and I wanted to bring it to your guys' attention. And with that, we'll go ahead and say goodbye, although it feels like we could go on for quite some time. There are lots of big issues here. We've been thrilled to have the time of Tom Chernak from Comply. Thank you so much, Tom, for joining us this week.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I keep saying it Comply. It's Comply, like the actual word would be. I thought it was like a Web 2.0. Oh, we're going to call it something cute that sounds, that looks like Comply. But it actually really is Comply, the name of the company. So it's been a real pleasure having you. Thank you for all the resources that you've put in our way and for running a great service.
Thanks so much. I hope to be back soon.
All right. We'd love to have you. Also, it's been wonderful chatting with you, Matt McDonald from Famigo.
Yeah, thanks. It's been nice to chat with you, Denise, and Tom and Evan as well.
We really appreciate the writing you've been doing about COPPA, the education you've been doing about COPPA. It's a difficult issue. And as I was saying, I wish I had been able to utilize your sandbox approach at a younger stage in my child's development.
Yeah, well, it's an exciting project to work on, and it's fun that the ground keeps moving under our feet. So I'm happy to help anytime.
Well, I mean, it must be a good idea because the phone companies themselves, the phone manufacturers themselves are copying you guys, right? Doesn't Windows Phone do some kind of sandbox kind of approach?
Yeah, we've seen a lot of people move into this space. We were founded in 2009, so we've been doing it for a little while, and we've seen, you know, even folks like Amazon has Kids Corner right now. But we've just launched a service with a mobile carrier ourselves, so hopefully you'll see us in a few more places.
Great, we will keep an eye out for that. Evan, great chatting with you again.
Yes, the same. Great to see you again. Really enjoyed our conversation. Learned a lot. You know, there's some really interesting dynamic things going on. So Matt and Tom, really enjoyed talking with you.
Me too. All right. Well, we will go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. But if you're lonely for us during the week, never fear. You can go to twit.tv/twill. Our entire archive of shows is there, going back all the way to our first episode in 2006. So you should go check that out. If you're behind on Twill, you can also find us at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw. And we're on Facebook and Google Plus and Twitter all through the week, too, when we're not doing the show. We'd love to hear from you in any of those formats to let us know what you think of the show. If you have guest suggestions for us, those are always very welcome. Also, of course, topic suggestions all the time. You guys are great about getting us stuff to pay attention to. We really appreciate that. Thanks so much for joining us on This Week in Law. We'll see you next week. Take care.